Chapter 40. Huddled ourselves under the streaming trees, and sent the Negro back home. It was a dismal and heartbreaking time. We were like to be drowned with the rain, deafened with the howling wind and the booming thunder, and blinded by the lightning. It was indeed a wild night. The drenching we were getting was misery enough, but a deeper misery still was the reflection that the halter might end us before we were a day older. A death of this shameful sort had not occurred to us as being among the possibilities of war. It took the romance all out of the campaign, and turned our dreams of glory into a repulsive nightmare. As for doubting that so barbarous an order had been given, not one of us did that. The long night wore itself out at last, and then the Negro came to us with the news that the alarm had manifestly been a false one, and that breakfast would soon be ready. Straightway we were light-hearted again, and the world was bright, and life as full of hope and promise as ever, for we were young then. How long ago that was? 24 years. The mongrel child of philology named the night's refuse camp devastation, and no soul objected. The masons gave us a Miss Sauri country breakfast, and Miss Sauri in abundance, and we needed it. Hot biscuits. Hot wheat bread prettily crisscrossed in a lattice pattern on top. Hot corn pone. Fried chicken. Bacon. Coffee. Eggs. Milk. Buttermilk. Etc. Semicolon, and the world may be confidently challenged to furnish the equal to such a breakfast as it is cooked in the South. We stayed several days at Mason's, and after all these years the memory of the dullness, the stillness and lifelessness of that slumberous farm-house still oppresses my spirit, as with a sense of the presence of death and mourning. There was nothing to do, nothing to think about. There was no interest in life. The male part of the household were away in the fields all day, the women were busy, and out of our sight. There was no sound, but the plaintive wailing of a spinning wheel, forever moaning out from some distant room the most lonesome sound in nature, a sound steeped and sodden with homesickness and the emptiness of life. The family went to bed about dark every night, and as we were not invited to intrude any new customs, we naturally followed theirs. Those nights were 100 years long to youths accustomed to being up till 12. We lay awake and miserable till that hour every time, and grew old, and decrepit waiting through the still eternities for the clock strikes. This was no place for town boys. So at last it was with something very like joy that we received news that the enemy were on our track again. With a new birth of the old warrior spirit, we sprang to our places in line of battle, and fell back on camp brawls. Captain Lyman had taken a hint from Mason's talk, and he now gave orders that our camp should be guarded against surprise by the posting of pickets. I was ordered to place a picket at the forks of the road in Hyde's Prairie. Night shut down black and threatening. I told Sergeant Bowers to go out to that place and stay till midnight, and, just as I was expecting, he said he wouldn't do it. I tried to get others to go, but all refused. Some excused themselves on account of the weather, but the rest were frank enough to say they wouldn't go in any kind of weather. This kind of thing sounds odd now, and impossible, but it seemed a perfectly natural thing to do. There were scores of little camps scattered over Miss Sauri, where the same thing was happening. These camps were composed of young men who had been born and reared to a sturdy independence, and who did not know what it meant to be ordered around by Tom, Dick, and Harry, whom they had known familiarly all their lives, in the village or on the farm. It is quite within the probabilities that the same thing was happening all over the South. James Redpath recognized the justice of this assumption, and furnished the following instance in support of it. During a short stay in East Tennessee, he was in a citizen colonel's tent one day, talking, when a big private appeared at the door, and without salute or other circumlocution said to the colonel, "Say, Jim, I'm a-going home for a few days." What for? Well, I ain't been there for a right smart while, and I'd like to see how things is coming on. Apostrophe, apostrophe, how long are you going to be gone? Apostrophe, apostrophe, about 2 weeks. Apostrophe, apostrophe, well, don't be gone longer than that, and get back sooner if you can. Apostrophe, apostrophe, that was all, and the citizen officer resumed his conversation, where the private had broken it off. This was in the first months of the war, of course. The camps in our part of Missouri were under Brigadier General Thomas H. Harris. He was a townsman of ours, a first-rate fellow, and well-liked, but we had all familiarly known him as the sole and modest salaried operator in our telegraph office, where he had to send about one dispatch a week in ordinary times, and two when there was a rush of business. Consequently, when he appeared in our midst one day, on the wing, and delivered a military command of some sort, in a large military fashion, nobody was surprised at the response which he got from the assembled soldiery. Oh, now, what'll you take to don't, Tom Harris? Apostrophe, apostrophe, it was quite the natural thing. One might justly imagine that we were hopeless material for war. And so we seemed, in our ignorant state, but there were those among us who afterward learned the grim trade, learned to obey like machines, became valuable soldiers, fought all through the war, and came out at the end with excellent records. One of the very boys who refused to go out on picket duty that night, and called me an ass for thinking he would expose himself to danger in such a foolhardy way, had become distinguished for intrepidity before he was a year older. I did secure my picket that night not by authority, but by diplomacy. I got Bowers to go, by agreeing to exchange ranks with him for the time being, and go along and stand the watch with him as his subordinate. We stayed out there a couple of dreary hours in the pitchy darkness and the rain, with nothing to modify the dreariness, but Bowers' monotonous growlings at the war and the weather. Then we began to nod, and presently found it next to impossible to stay in the saddle. So we gave up the tedious job, and went back to the camp without waiting for the relief guard. We rode into camp without interruption or objection from anybody, and the enemy could have done the same, for there were no sentries. Everybody was asleep. At midnight there was nobody to send out another picket, so none was sent. We never tried to establish a watch at night again, as far as I remember, but we generally kept a picket out in the daytime. In that camp the whole command slept on the corn in the big corn crib, and there was usually a general row before morning, for the place was full of rats, and they would scramble over the boys' bodies and faces, annoying and irritating everybody. And now and then they would bite someone's toe, and the person who owned the toe would start up, and magnify his English, and begin to throw corn in the dark. The ears were half as heavy as bricks, and when they struck they hurt. The person struck would respond, and inside of 5 minutes every man would be locked in a death grip with his neighbor. There was a grievous deal of bloodshed in the corn crib, but this was all that was spilt while I was in the war. No, that is not quite true. But for one circumstance it would have been all. I will come to that now. Our scares were frequent. Every few days rumors would come that the enemy were approaching. In these cases we always fell back on some other camp of ours. We never stayed where we were. But the rumors always turned out to be false, so at last even we began to grow indifferent to them. One night a Negro was sent to our corn crib with the same old warning. The enemy was hovering in our neighborhood. We all said let him hover. We resolved to stay still and be comfortable. It was a fine warlike resolution, and no doubt we all felt the stir of it in our veins for a moment. We had been having a very jolly time that was full of horseplay and schoolboy hilarity. But that cooled down now, and presently the fast waning fire of forced jokes and forced laughs died out altogether, and the company became silent. Silent and nervous. And soon uneasy, worried, apprehensive. We had said we would stay, and we were committed. We could have been persuaded to go, but there was nobody brave enough to suggest it. An almost noiseless movement presently began in the dark, by a general and unvoiced impulse. When the movement was completed, each man knew that he was not the only person who had crept to the front wall and had his eye at a crack between the logs. No, we were all there with our hearts in our throats, and staring out toward the sugar troughs, where the forest footpath came through. It was late, and there was a deep woodsy stillness everywhere. There was a veiled moonlight, which was only just strong enough to enable us to mark the general shape of objects. Presently a muffled sound caught our ears, and we recognized it as the hoofbeats of a horse or horses. And right away a figure appeared in the forest path. It could have been made of smoke, its mass had so little sharpness of outline. It was a man on horseback, and it seemed to me that there were others behind him. I got hold of a gun in the dark, and pushed it through a crack between the logs, hardly knowing what I was doing, I was so dazed with fright. Somebody set fire. I pulled the trigger. I seemed to see 100 flashes, and hear 100 reports, then I saw the man fall down out of the saddle. My first feeling was of surprised gratification. My first impulse was an apprentice sportsman's impulse to run and pick up his game. Somebody said, hardly audibly, "Good, we've got him. Wait for the rest." But the rest did not come. There was not a sound, not the whisper of a leaf. Just perfect stillness. An uncanny kind of stillness, which was all the more uncanny on account of the damp, earthy late night smells now rising and pervading it. Then, wondering, we crept stealthily out and approached the man. When we got to him, the moon revealed him distinctly. He was lying on his back, with his arms abroad. His mouth was open, and his chest heaving with long gasps, and his white shirt front was all splashed with blood. The thought shot through me that I was a murderer, that I had killed a man who had never done me any harm. That was the coldest sensation that ever went through my marrow. I was down by him in a moment, helplessly stroking his forehead. And I would have given anything then, my own life freely, to make him again what he had been 5 minutes before. And all the boys seemed to be feeling in the same way. They hung over him, full of pitying interest, and tried all they could to help him, and said all sorts of regretful things. They had forgotten all about the enemy. They thought only of this one forlorn unit of the foe. Once my imagination persuaded me that the dying man gave me a reproachful look out of his shadowy eyes, and it seemed to me that I would rather he had stabbed me than done that. He muttered and mumbled like a dreamer in his sleep about his wife and child, and I thought with a new despair, this thing that I have done does not end with him. It falls upon them too, and they never did me any harm, any more than he. In a little while the man was dead. He was killed in war, killed in fair and legitimate war, killed in battle, as you might say, and yet he was as sincerely mourned by the opposing force as if he had been their brother. The boys stood there a half hour sorrowing over him, and recalling the details of the tragedy, and wondering who he might be, and if he were a spy, and saying that if it were to do over again they would not hurt him, unless he attacked them first. It soon came out that mine was not the only shot fired. There were 5 others, a division of the guilt which was a grateful relief to me, since it in some degree lightened, and diminished the burden I was carrying. There were 6 shots fired at once, but I was not in my right mind at the time, and my heated imagination had magnified my one shot into a volley. The man was not in uniform, and was not armed. He was a stranger in the country, that was all we ever found out about him. The thought of him got to preying upon me every night. I could not get rid of it. I could not drive it away. The taking of that unoffending life seemed such a wanton thing. And it seemed an epitome of war, that all war must be just that, the killing of strangers against whom you feel no personal animosity, strangers whom, in other circumstances, you would help if you found them in trouble, and who would help you if you needed it. My campaign was spoiled. It seemed to me that I was not rightly equipped for this awful business. That war was intended for men, and I for a child's nurse. I resolved to retire from this avocation of sham soldiership, while I could save some remnant of my self-respect. These morbid thoughts clung to me against reason, for at bottom I did not believe I had touched that man. The law of probabilities decreed me guiltless of his blood, for in all my small experience with guns I had never hit anything I had tried to hit, and I knew I had done my best to hit him. Yet there was no solace in the thought. Against a diseased imagination, demonstration goes for nothing. The rest of my war experience was of a piece with what I have already told of it. We kept monotonously falling back upon one camp or another, and eating up the country. I marvel now at the patience of the farmers and their families. They ought to have shot us. On the contrary, they were as hospitably kind and courteous to us as if we had deserved it. In one of these camps we found Ab Grimes, an Upper Mississippi pilot, who afterwards became famous as a daredevil rebel spy, whose career bristled with desperate adventures. The look and style of his comrades suggested that they had not come into the war to play, and their deeds made good the conjecture later. They were fine horsemen and good revolver shots, but their favorite arm was the lasso. Each had one at his pommel, and could snatch a man out of the saddle with it every time, on a full gallop, at any reasonable distance. In another camp the chief was a fierce and profane old blacksmith of 60, and he had furnished his 20 recruits with gigantic homemade Bowie knives, to be swung with the two hands, like the machetes of the Isthmus. It was a grisly spectacle to see that earnest band practicing their murderous cuts and slashes under the eye of that remorseless old fanatic. The last camp which we fell back upon was in a hollow near the village of Florida, where I was born in Monroe County. Here we were warned one day that a Union colonel was sweeping down on us with a whole regiment at his heels. This looked decidedly serious. Our boys went apart and consulted. Then we went back, and told the other companies present that the war was a disappointment to us, and we were going to disband. They were getting ready, themselves, to fall back on some place or other, and were only waiting for General Tom Harris, who was expected to arrive at any moment, so they tried to persuade us to wait a little while, but the majority of us said no, we were accustomed to falling back, and didn't need any of Tom Harris's help. We could get along perfectly well without him, and save time too. So about half of our 15, including myself, mounted and left on the instant. The others yielded to persuasion and stayed through the war. An hour later we met General Harris on the road, with two or three people in his company, his staff, probably, but we could not tell. None of them was in uniform. Uniforms had not come into vogue among us yet. Harris ordered us back, but we told him there was a Union colonel coming with a whole regiment in his wake, and it looked as if there was going to be a disturbance, so we had concluded to go home. He raged a little, but it was of no use. Our minds were made up. We had done our share, had killed one man, exterminated one army, such as it was, let him go, and kill the rest, and that would end the war. I did not see that brisk young general again until last year. Then he was wearing white hair and whiskers. In time I came to know that Union colonel whose coming frightened me out of the war, and crippled the Southern cause to that extent, General Grant. I came within a few hours of seeing him, when he was as unknown as I was myself, at a time when anybody could have said, Grant? Ulysses S. Grant? I do not remember hearing the name before. Apostrophe. It seems difficult to realize that there was once a time when such a remark could be rationally made, but there was, and I was within a few miles of the place and the occasion too, though proceeding in the other direction. The thoughtful will not throw this war paper of mine lightly aside as being valueless. It has this value. It is a not unfair picture of what went on in many and many a militia camp in the first months of the rebellion, when the green recruits were without discipline, Without the steadying and heartening influence or trained leaders, when all their circumstances were new and strange, and charged with exaggerated terrors, and before the invaluable experience of actual collision in the field had turned them from rabbits into soldiers. If the sight of the picture of that early day has not before been put into history, then history has been to that degree incomplete, for it had and has its rightful place there. There was more Bull Run material scattered through the early camps of this country than exhibited itself at Bull Run. And yet it learned its trade presently, and helped to fight the great battles later. I could have become a soldier myself, if I had waited. I had got part of it learned. I knew more about retreating than the man that invented retreating. 1. It was always my impression that that was what the horse was there for, and I know that it was also the impression of at least one other of the command, for we talked about it at the time, and admired the military ingenuity of the device. But when I was out west 3 years ago, I was told by Mr. A.G. Fuqua, a member of our company, that the horse was his, that the leaving him tied at the door was a matter of mere forgetfulness, and that to attribute it to intelligent invention was to give him quite too much credit. In support of his position, he called my attention to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.